Back at it for you on Tuesday, September 29th, right here on Connecticut Today. In the 3 p.m. hour, we welcomed an attorney from the Landmark Legal Foundation, a conservative group, to talk about the nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to take the seat of the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the U.S. Supreme Court. We checked in with one of our go-to guys in the 4 o'clock hour, Professor and Dr. Gary Rose, who chairs the Government Department at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. We talked about the state of the presidential campaign and kind of a pregame look at the big debate coming up tonight is, of course, the nomination of Federal Circuit Court Judge Amy Coney Barrett to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court. Pending a confirmation that seems to be in the bag, Judge Barrett would take the seat of the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. A lot has been made about what she has said or hasn't said or could say about the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, as it's actually called. What did she say? What didn't she say? How could this figure into the court? Joining us right now from the Landmark Legal Foundation, Assistant General Counsel and Ed Meese, the third legal counsel, Matt Forries, to talk about that. Matt, Paul here at WICC in Bridgeport. How are you on this Tuesday?
Great. And thanks so much for having me on.
So let's talk about what I know your organization is focusing on and legal challenges here to the Affordable Care Act, better known, you know, to a lot of folks as Obamacare, and what dynamic Judge Barrett might play here. What's your overall, Matt, assessment of the situation? What's being said that's accurate and what's being said that's inaccurate here?
Okay. Well, first off, it's interesting that we're focusing on this because I think religion was kind of raised ham-handedly, you know, in the first go round in her 2017 hearings for the circuit court. And I think that kind of fell flat. And I don't think the Democrats in the Senate want to touch that again. So they're coming back and attacking her on two different approaches. First, that the entire process is illegitimate. And I believe Senator Blumenthal tweeted over the weekend that he would refuse to treat the process as legitimate and wouldn't even meet with her. And then the second approach is the claim that she's going to take away everyone's health care. And Vice President Biden said he's accused President Trump of appointing her to eliminate the ACA and to steal away health care. So a lot of this stems from a book review that she wrote a few years ago. Not a case, but just a book review. And if I can just, the statement that she made was that Chief Justice Roberts pushed the Affordable Care Act beyond its plausible meaning to save the statute.
Yeah.
And what she said there was exactly what Justice Scalia and the conservative justices believed in the prior big Obamacare case. And that was NFIB versus Sebelius. So people are focusing on that statement to imply because she said that, she's a lock to overturn the entire statute. But that really can't be justified by the case coming before the court because the situation in that case is radically different.
Okay, so they're honing in, you say, then, they're cherry-picking here, Matt, is what you're saying, correct?
Yes. They're trying to extrapolate from one sentence that is really kind of consistent with conservative thought about the original Obamacare case. And I have to get into the weeds just a little bit to describe the case, I think, for people to understand what the issues were on the first case.
Yeah, let's do that. I want you to do that. Let's do that after we take a quick break here, Matt. Yeah, please, sure. I want you to do that because, again, I want to kind of get into the weeds here to see exactly what's accurate on this and what isn't. Matt Forries joins us, Assistant General Counsel, the Ed Meese III Legal Counsel at the Landmark Legal Foundation, talking about a sentence that maybe many detractors of Judge Amy Coney Barrett have latched onto, saying, well, she's a lock to turn over the Affordable Care Act. Okay, Matt, stand by. We'll be back with you shortly. Traffic and weather together, 3:36 on WICC. We are joined for a few more minutes by Matt Forries. He is Assistant General Counsel and the Ed Meese III Legal Counsel at the Landmark Legal Foundation, talking with him about the nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court. Assuming she's cleared by the Senate, Judge Barrett would take the empty seat vacated by the death a couple of weeks ago Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Justice Ginsburg, and we're talking about a likely line of questioning or attack that may come from any Democratic committee members on the judiciary if they choose to even attend that proceeding regarding a statement Judge Barrett made in 2017 regarding the Affordable Care Act. There are people like our guest Matt who are saying, wait a minute, this is not the entire story. So, Matt, you wanted to get into the weeds of this case a little bit legally and maybe why Judge Barrett said what she said. Go right ahead.
Sure. So back in the original case in NFIB versus Sebelius, one of the main issues was the individual mandate. And the individual mandate was the provision in the law that says, told people you have to have health insurance, and if you don't, you pay a penalty, right? So that came before the court, and it was one part of a massive 1,000-page statute, which did all kinds of things. It increased, you know, Medicaid dollars for the states. It changed the rules for pre-existing conditions and community ratings and so forth. And the Supreme Court, five justices, the conservatives, found that the individual mandate, the compelling people to buy health insurance, violated the Commerce Clause. But what happened, what was a surprise, was the Chief Justice Roberts interpreted it, however, as a tax. Okay, he used a what was called a savings construction, said, I'm going to look at this not as a mandate and regulatory penalty, but as a tax. And under that situation, it was upheld. Okay. And notice also the court found that the coercing the states to change their Medicaid rules was unconstitutional. That did not mean they threw out the entire 900-page statute. Okay. So conservatives were pretty much in unison that what Chief Justice Roberts did was almost doing violence to the words. And that's what Amy Coney Barrett was kind of saying, that what Chief Justice Roberts did was took the words of the law beyond its plausible meaning to save the statute. Okay? So what is different this time? People are going to say, well, now it's going to be a big deal that she's replacing Justice Ginsburg. This is just one more vote now to say that the mandate on its own telling people to buy insurance is unconstitutional. Now, what happened since that case is in 2017, Congress amended the Affordable Care Act to get rid of the tax element. It used to be you had to pay a certain amount of tax to the IRS if you didn't buy health insurance. They changed that to zero. So now you've got no tax payable, right? What's left is a mandate to buy insurance, but there's nothing to back it up. Mm-hmm. So when you look at this theoretically, you can't really justify this as a tax anymore. So that puts the individual mandate at doubt at this point, okay? Now, people are using this to say, oh, my goodness, this means the entire law is going to be thrown out. Well, there are two reasons why this is not likely to happen. It's called standing and severability. First off, the case before us now are some states are challenging the individual mandate, and the standing to get them to the court is a little bit more complicated. So that's a hurdle they're going to have to meet. The second part is severability, and that's the doctrine the court uses when they find part of a law unconstitutional. Do they strike the entire thing down? Do they use a bulldozer when a scalpel is necessary, is how Chief Justice Roberts referred to it. It's much more likely that they're going to be hesitant to overturn the entire law. Okay? So the argument that the entire Obamacare statute is going to be thrown out because of this new case, and the case is called California v. Texas, is really, really implausible.
Yeah, I mean, no, you know, I don't think any gathering, Matt, of jurists, of federal judges or Supreme Court justices, no matter how literalist they are to the Constitution, nobody, I think, wants to completely trash a law. At least this is my guess. I could be wrong. Nobody, I think, wants to completely trash a law that would suddenly and maybe irreparably leave millions of Americans hanging in the balance with their health care. I just don't think that they would want to do that. I could be wrong, but that's my guess.
You know, some of her close friends have noted, this is friends of Judge Amy Coney Barrett, she's a mom of seven children. One of them has special needs. And another one, when she adopted her, had some serious health problems that they weren't even sure if she's going to be able to walk. So I really doubt she's going to be the kind of person who's going to come to the court and be cavalier about the entire process, right? But I, on the flip side, I do think she's a judge who comes in and looks at laws the way Justice Scalia did and will adhere to the statutes as written. Now, part of being a Scalia-type justice is also she defends economic regulations from Congress by a deferential standard known as rational basis. So she's not likely to overturn an economic law, regulatory law, if it can be upheld, you know, and does not violate any other provision of the Constitution. So I really think that the charge that she's going to overturn Obamacare is really over the top.
Matt, I've seen stuff written over the past week or so, the past few days, rather, since her announcement. Even by left-leaning columnists, jurists, legal scholars who say they don't agree with her politics maybe or her interpretations of something, but they've also said, a surprising number have said, she is well qualified to be a justice at that level. Her opinions on things set aside, I've seen very few of any people impugning her raw credentials to be on the court.
Yeah, there's no question she's considered a bright light, just a remarkable academic with a long record of speaking and writing very clearly and effectively on constitutional doctrine, stare decisis, and the court's role in society. And I just want to remind everybody, this is something conservatives wanted a long time. We don't want our lives run by judges. We want the people to have more of a say in how the country is run, right? We didn't have a revolution in 1776 to turn things over to nine people sitting in a court. We want to have a little bit more say in how the country's run, and we don't want judges to go up there and create new laws on their own. That's not the role of a judge. So she sees herself in that tradition, someone whose job is to interpret the law and not to strike something down because of her personal opinions.
And maybe, Matt, the goal from Congress here would be, as another columnist I read the other day who was kind of a centrist, saying, well, write better laws, write legislation, take your time, don't jam this stuff through for political purposes, write laws with the, you know, thinking that, hey, we've got to make this bulletproof, as it were, to legal challenges, write better legislation.
Absolutely. It's going to change the dynamic in Washington. For a long time, Congress has kind of gotten away with being sloppy about their role, leaving much to be done by the administrative state, the bureaucrats who are in Washington, giving them great deference, writing very vaguely worded statutes. And I think that kind of thing is going to come to an end with a 6-3 conservative majority on the Supreme Court.
All right, from the Landmark Legal Foundation, Assistant General Counsel. He's the Ed Meese, the third legal counsel there at the foundation, Matt Forese. Matt, thanks for taking the time. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it. Matthew C. Forese, F-O-R-Y-S. He's the Assistant General Counsel and the Ed Meese, the third legal counsel at the Landmark Legal Foundation. Maybe we'll get the opinion of one of our go-to guys, Dr. Gary Rose, professor of and chair of the Poli-Sci Department, government department at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. Gary, Paul here, as always. How are you?
Good, Paul. How are you?
I'm good. Listen, I hope you heard this. Did you hear this breaking news? This is serious. I'm not kidding here. The Trump campaign did not agree today to breaks in the procedures tonight, I guess the 90 minutes, the Biden camp and said, hey, can we take some breaks? The Trump campaign said no. So the Biden camp is now, Gary, rescinding their offer to let their candidate be checked for inner ear devices.
Could it get any more ridiculous?
Gary, this is not a spoof. I'm serious. Biden said, well, if you're not going to give me, you know, Gary, we're all up there. We all need our breaks. Apparently, they're not going to allow breaks. So Joe says, you can't check my ears. Oh, man, this is just wild, isn't it?
Oh, it is. And, you know, there's these accusations that Biden is on performance-enhancing drugs and now this. And it's just, you know, what is unfortunate here, Paul, is it's really a diversion away from really the issues facing this country. And that's really what this debate should be about.
How about this format, though? I am surprised. Chris Wallace, who did a great job interviewing President Trump a couple of weeks ago, you know, really took him apart. Joe Biden will not be, you know, he didn't consent to go on Fox News Sunday. So, you know, he'll have to face Chris Wallace tonight. 6 15-minute segments on various topics. But I'm sure Mr. Biden and his camp, Gary, are going to try and get that tax thing in there as much as they can.
Oh, absolutely. And there's no doubt about it that President Trump is going to attempt to drag Hunter Biden into this as well. And so I think what you're going to see are, you know, very good questions from Chris Wallace. And I agree with you. He was excellent the last time he moderated. He's an excellent journalist. But at the same time, I'm certain that both Biden and Trump will somehow take those questions and convert them to really more personal issues, you know, opposed to the candidate that they really feel, you know, needs to be brought down. And that's Trump is going to try to bring Biden down on personal issues, and Biden's going to try to bring Trump down on personal issues, regardless of whether or not the question has to do with health care or the election or whatever. This is really a very, you know, personal campaign that's been unfolding, and there's no question in my mind that that they're going to try to make this about character and personality more than anything else.
I wonder, Gary, what the visual will tell us tonight. You know, somebody said the other day, I think it was Joe Rogan on his podcast, who is no conservative, but he's got millions of followers. He said, you know, say what you will about Trump. He hasn't really, now, obviously, there's the comb over and the makeup and everything. And, you know, he's not the most healthy guy, but he hasn't really aged all that much as he did, you know, from when he took office. Whereas, you know, when you look at Joe Biden, he is, I mean, even from just 4 years ago, Gary, he has visibly aged. He's not a young man. And I just wonder what, if any, impression the visual will be with people tonight. Maybe yes, maybe no. I don't know.
Well, yeah, that's a very good point. And it is true that that former Vice President Biden does look increasingly feeble. And the way he's walking, he seems a little bit unsteady at times. And, you know, really what you're getting at here, and it's really an excellent point, is that so much of a debate turns on style and how one appears and how one makes a delivery as opposed to the actual content of what they're saying. And it's really more of a visual, you know, type of experience, because very few people can ever remember, you know, the policy prescriptions and how the candidates differed on, you know, on domestic or foreign policy issues. But when it comes to actually how they presented themselves, how they stood at their podiums, how they presented on stage, and the forcefulness of their delivery, that certainly can move debaters. And so in that respect, I would say, Paul, that, you know, the cards are in Trump's favor there, because he does look better on his feet, at least up to this point.
And let's not forget, Gary, this is a guy who had a pretty top-rated television show for, what, 7, 8? I mean, people forget that this guy, now granted it wasn't live, it was taped segments, but still, you know, here's a guy doing that. And as you say, Gary, you know, people think of the Nixon-Kennedy debate. What's the first thing they think of? As you said, not policy, how great Kennedy looked, how awful Nixon looked. And again, I hearken back, Gary, earlier to, you know, That fateful checking of his watch that George Bush did. Do you remember that with Clinton?
Yes, I do. Sure.
And people are like, "What does he want to get out of there?"
Yeah, he seemed bored. Yeah, and he seemed very disinterested in the forum that was taking place. So much tonight. It's going to be a great debate, nevertheless. But so much of it, I think, is going to be personal. It's going to be more about character. I think style is going to be very important, and which is, again, you know, as one who studies politics, a little unfortunate, because a debate really should be about who is in command of the multiple issues currently facing this country. But And I'm hoping that Wallace keeps trying to, you know, take the respondents back to that. But I'm afraid, as you prefaced this discussion, I think both candidates up there are going to try to kind of steer the debate away from policy and more towards character.
Dr. Gary Rose, Sacred Heart University, is the guest. Gary, hang on. We'll do one more segment with you. More with Dr. Gary Rose, chair of the Government Poli-Sci Department at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. Straight ahead, first, traffic and weather together on WICC. A few more minutes with one of our go-to guys, Dr. Gary Rose, who is chair and professor of government at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield. Boy, Gary, it's no surprise to me that the lines are so delineated on the Trump tax story. Half the country thinks he's Lucifer, Beelzebub, and should be drawn and quartered for paying the taxes or he didn't pay. And the other half says, how do I get a hold of his accountants? How do I, right?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, $750. Yeah, right. I know. He must have some incredible accountants. They must be brilliant in order to come up with a plan there where somebody is so incredibly wealthy pays so little. Almost nothing, actually.
And but it's funny. I see the responses I get on social media, but luckily, Gary, I do have friends who look at the sub issue here, which is this is possible. We're assuming none of it's illegal. It may be, but this is possible, Gary, right? Because of the laws that Congress writes.
From what I can tell, I mean, I don't know the ins and outs of all these loopholes, but apparently Trump has been within his legal right to exploit every loophole that he can find, at least his accounts, that is. And you're right. It comes down to the tax laws that allow, real estate men like him to find various ways of having deductions and losses and everything else to the point where he ends up paying virtually nothing. And it's not a function of deception. It's not a function of breaking the law, like you say. It's just a function of knowing how to use existing federal tax laws and state tax laws, too.
Gary, I'm reading a couple of things today. I try to read all the way from the left to the right, all the spectrum. And I'm finding more and more people who say at this point, even though we're 5 weeks out, they say, well, the debates, whatever, watch them, whatever. But according to what they're seeing in the polls, and as steady as so many of these polls are, I'm seeing more and more people, Gary, saying the race is over. It's not going to change. It is over. You buy that?
Well, no, I don't buy it, although I understand that point of view, because President Trump's public approval ratings have been consistently below 50% ever since he's taken office. They haven't really budged much. And when you are below 50%, an incumbent who's running for re-election like this, that really normally spells defeat. At the same time, I wouldn't say it's over, because we still have, in some of the key swing states, those in the Rust Belt, where Trump was able to pull that upset off in 2016, we still have some persuadable voters. And I believe that's why these debates starting tonight are take on increased importance. Even though we're only talking about maybe 9 or 10% of the electorate now that's really in the persuadable category, it really doesn't take all that much to move states like Wisconsin or Michigan. If you get a small percentage of persuadable voters going towards Trump, that could actually tip those states and give him the Electoral College vote. So I don't believe it's over. No, I would never say it's over. It's looking bad. Yes, it is looking very good for Joe Biden. He's ahead not just in the national polls, but he's ahead in so many of the state polls, too. But no, this is not over, because even though debates like tonight are confirming exercises, people see what they want, we still have a small percentage of the electorate that can be moved based on debates, and those voters could make a difference.
And finally, Gary, we're getting all sorts of projections, prognostications. You probably read these, too, that because of the expected influx of these mail-in ballots, going to bed at 1 or 2 a.m. in the morning after the election is over, that might not benefit people if they really want to know who run. I mean, I'm seeing more who won, rather. I'm seeing more and more projections on this, Gary, that this could stretch out for days.
It could, and because a good number of the states don't require, you know, these mail-in ballots to actually be counted until a week or so after the election. And you know, so it is true. There are those that are expecting, because Republicans right now are indicating that they will vote in person, and more Democrats are saying they'll vote by mail. So the question is, could you have, you know, Donald Trump declared a winner on the night of November 3rd, mm-hmm. and then maybe a week later or so, could, once we get all the mail-in ballots counted, could we have Joe Biden declared a winner? And wouldn't that be something? And that's why we need 9 members on the U.S. Supreme Court in order to decide the election. And I hope it doesn't go to that, but it might. It might.
But, Gary, if it did go to that, just think of the teaching material you'll have for your students, right?
What a great course. I know. Here we go. I know. That's right.
Okay, boys and girls, this is not in a book now. This is really happening.
I know. It's amazing what this generation is living through, the
yes.
pandemic and this type of election, and now what's going on with the Supreme Court. It's extraordinary what my students are encountering, mm-hmm. particularly those who study politics.
Great stuff. Dr. Gary Rose, professor and chair, government division, government studies at Sacred Heart University. Gary, thank you as always. We'll be in touch. Thanks.
Okay. All right.
Appreciate it. Good man there. Dr. Gary Rose, professor and chair of the government department at Sacred Heart University.